wheels and let the highway take you to a northern city somewhere far away. Welcome to BluePower.com. This is part number three, the closing show for The Best Music You've Never Heard, featuring Rastus from Cleveland, Ohio. Tonight I have with me Mr. Jim Cantelli. Jim and I spent many, many long hours with this band, working diligently to promote and help this band secure prominence in the top 10, which was never to be. And
we took them all the way to the bottom, John.
Took them all the way to the bottom. I got to tell you something. I don't know if you remember, Jimmy, but there was one New Year's Eve show that we had to do at the Scene, and I remember we were like 800 miles away or something and had to go like hell to get there on time to play that gig. All kinds of insane stuff happened, I remember. But one thing was that by 1:30 in the morning, I think we played, I think the band had played four sets or something like that, and they still had one more to play. And who was the guy there that made them play for two people, made the band
New
play?
New York Charlie.
New York Charlie. I'll always forget New York Charlie.
Who was at that time married to our dear friend Benny.
That's true. True.
Benny Balestrieri, a female, I might add.
Yeah, Benedetta. Beautiful Benny. But we had lots of problems, and it was around this time and that strange things started happening to the band. And I believe the band at that time now was in the second farmhouse in Chardon, Ohio, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And things were pretty desperate, pretty damn desperate. Gigs were hard to find. Money was tight. Money was always tight. Money had always been tight with this band. Is your deuce? Angelo would say, is your deuce?
Probably elaborate on the deuce.
Go ahead, elaborate.
We most bands today get a per diem. They get like anywhere from $50 to $50 up a day to eat and do your laundry and whatever other little incidental tchotchkes you do on the road. It's a standard thing. Businesses do it also, but in those days, we got our per diem, and it wasn't called per diem. It was called the deuce
because
we got $2 a day.
Yeah, $2 a day, man.
And it's amazing how far you can stretch $2 when you have friends who feed you.
And the people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin were tremendous.
They were incredible.
They really were. A lot of great fans there. And there were a lot of people that really took care of us.
A lot of very generous women.
Very generous women and wonderful people. There was Betty and Barbara.
Betty and Barbara.
Right. And then there was Carol, who worked was the waitress in the Chinese restaurant upstairs, who used to feed us for free every morning.
Right.
And a lot of people that took care of us, let us take showers. People were living everywhere, but I was living in this studio complex, which was a mall, a shopping center.
A strip mall,
and at one point, where I was living had been household finance. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, where I slept in a room where they used to take people in and beat them up because they hadn't made payments on their car. It really did not have a great feel to it. But it was an insane place. The studio was total insanity. Sonad Studios. And I want to talk a little bit about that because at that point there was, what was his name? Come and give it to me, the old man.
Not Kurt.
Kurt Knoppel.
Kurt Knoppel.
Yeah, Kurt Knoppel, who was like our mentor. And
sort of.
Yeah, in a way. And our alleged mentor, who actually ran out on the company and stole a patent, and I hope he comes after me for that, because I certainly would like to go to court with him, because that patent today is Aphex, and I don't mind saying it, and none of us would be poor as we are now if we had had that patent. We worked on it for almost a year and got most of the bugs out. And then all of a sudden, Kurt disappears, goes back to Sweden to bury his dead father, who had been dead for several years. We found out from the INS later. But that's another story, Jim.
That's a whole other
show.
We
could do another whole show about that. And am I angry? Yes. Not as angry as I used to be. But let's play another piece of music from Rastus, because this truly was a great band. And we were talking about the ups and downs and the pratfalls and the pitfalls that they fell into. I mean, just working with no money was hard enough. And then so many people. How many people were... We had, what,
probably
nine?
12 or 15, including a couple of crew. And
yeah, and the manager.
Of course. And I was one of the crew. I was the crew at one
you
time.
You were. You were the crew. And
and eventually we got, at that point, I had a couple of assistants. One guy that was kind of worthless and one guy that was really a good guy, Robin Steinberg.
Oh,
was
yeah,
a great
Robin.
Guy.
Nice cat, man.
Great guy. Worked hard and really took care of the band. And we got a lot of compliments on the way we took care of things and the way it sounded with the perimeter equipment that we had at the time.
And it was primitive. I think we have better equipment sitting here right now.
Oh yeah.
Than we did when we were on the road with those guys. But let's play another piece of music now. Let's play a live cut from the scene, as a matter of fact, from the live album. Nell DeGreb, the telephone company, has cut us off a Tracy Nelson song. What do you say, Jim?
Yeah, Tracy.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you. Come on. Come on.
Thank you.
Good night, Nell DeGreb. The telephone company has cut us off. And that's a Tracy Nelson song. I do believe it was another writer on that. I'll have to look and see if there was. But that was some of the power that Rastus had live. And that was in front of, what, about 3,000 people?
Yeah. Nice
Scene,
crowd.
Scene was such a great club. It really was. Marvelous place to record and also to play. Now, you had brought up some points about what started happening at this point to the band. I remember one day they called me when we were in Milwaukee, I believe, and they called me up to the Holiday Inn or something where Angelo was staying and said, yeah, you know, you're out.
Yeah, that was shortly after that last trip to Milwaukee there on the New Year's.
Yeah.
And it was a shock to me as well. Bands are strange. They all have a lot of the same characteristics.
Yeah.
These guys were tired of being produced.
They wanted to produce themselves.
I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, all of a sudden, after approximately 2 years of being on the road and
lots
and working,
of hard work,
lots of hard work, I found myself outside, and and everybody left town without me, and I went back to Detroit and just continued doing what I was doing. Next thing I know, I got a call from. Was it you that called me, or was it Angelo that called? Somebody called from Chicago.
Somebody, in that band, somebody was always delegated to do the dirty work.
Yeah.
So it might have been me, and it might have been Angelo that called you, but they were desperate. They were recording. They had a deal with Neighborhood Records at the time, and they were recording in a studio in Chicago that was probably a little better than the one we had in Milwaukee, but they weren't getting the results that they got out of the stuff that you did for them. So I remember they were frustrated. They were really frustrated. They were just MFing the engineer up and down behind his back. And, there was going to be a lynching.
Yeah.
So somebody, probably Mike and Angelo, who were the two decision makers in the band, determined that they needed to bring you back. And which was a good move because you put a little of the funk back in it,
Yeah, I could never understand why, because I know that Paragon, that's where they recorded in Chicago, it's Marty Feldman's place, cut a lot of hits, and I don't know, maybe the engineer just didn't know the room what, but when I heard the stuff, it just laid there.
I think he knew the room. I think he just didn't know the band, and I think he had a whole different style than you. I mean, he never got to really know them. He was just all business and real straight up, straight arrow type guy, and never got into the feeling of the band,
The feeling, man. They had a feeling, all right.
The feeling was don't turn your back.
That's true. That's true, and keep both hands in your pockets.
That's right. And if you steal it, you eat it.
That's right. Absolutely. You steal it, you eat it. That's another story.
That's another story.
So anyway, they did this record. I went in and I remixed half of it and edited a bunch. And then I left, and I did mostly because there were a lot of my tunes on this album, and I wanted to make sure that at least they sounded halfway decent. But then they signed with Neighborhood Records.
Peter Shakarik. The husband of the then pop star Melanie. And
what was that, Candle in the Rain?
No, Candles? Her big song was, I got a brand new pair of rolling
shoes. Oh, right. I remember now.
And she had a couple other hits, too. But Peter Shakarik gave them a bunch of money and to get a house, another house, which this time was in New York because his offices were in the Gulf Western building in New York. So we got a house up in a little town called Highmount that was on Route 28, just about 20 miles outside of Woodstock, in a beautiful area of the Catskills, where a lot of the bands of that time lived. There was
the band. Yeah,
and several other big artists at the time were living up there. So we became part of that community and commuted in and out of New York to deal with Peter and all the business. I think I found the house and for a time there we were sort of in limbo between moves and it ended up to be a great place to live and to put an album together, but it wasn't the same. The band was sort of in decline. I mean, everything was the band was tight. They were sounding good live. They never sounded better. Just the business end was falling apart. Peter was keeping it together. You know, he put a single out on them, Lazy Kind of Day.
Yeah, Lazy Kind of Day.
And it just wasn't the same anymore. It became they were trying to get their business heads into the mix there, and it wasn't happening. It just wasn't happening. And everybody was sort of suspicious of each other, and everybody was, you know, starting to decline into arguments. And there we were in New York, though, putting another album together. And the picture on the second album was taken on the steps of the house.
Yeah.
And I used to go in to deal with Peter a lot, so I ended up hanging out in his office a lot. And he would put me to work when he could, but I ended up hanging out with Michael Lang, the guy who put Woodstock together, who had an office in the same suite of offices. Interesting times. But the band itself was just starting to decline. They weren't getting along very well at the time.
So it really wasn't a lazy kind of day.
No, it wasn't. I think the song was written quite a bit before that.
Yeah. Why don't we play that single?
It was written by Smokey. I'd love to hear it.
To do, it's just
she was. I like Janice. Okay, here we go. So that was Lazy Kind of Day, Jim, and that was the only single that was released on, I think, on the from the second album. Neighborhood released that single. The other side, the which was the A side anyway?
The A side was Lazy Kind of Day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wasn't Lucy Bluebird, huh?
I don't think so.
Well, so now there's problems in River City, and the band leaves New York and comes to the West Coast. I had left and already come out to California in the early part of 1971. And next thing I know, I hear Rastus is coming to the West Coast. And I've now gotten a friend of mine, Jack Lee's, owned a studio called Hollywood Central. And I had gone in there and we took the studio and actually rebuilt it. And got it working. And I hear that Rastus is headed toward the West Coast. And they're going to play a place called the Brass Ring, which was a place where Delaney and Bonnie played, and Neil Young and Crazy Horse. And I think Crazy Horse is like kind of like the house band there for a while.
They were, yeah.
Yeah. I remember one night Rastus was playing in the Brass Ring. And a couple of big guys came in with some girls, and they were whooping it up. And Rastus had just played a set and came off, and everybody had, like, gone outside to have a cigarette or whatever they do outside. And on the way back in, Don Nagy was walking by the booth where these two big guys were, who were actually off-duty policemen. And one of these off-duty policemen had his feet out in the aisle, and Don tripped over his feet. Why don't you tell us what happened, Jim?
Well, you got to understand that at that time there were people that had long hair. And
yeah, lots
people
of
who,
people.
And people who didn't have long hair.
And these guys did not have long hair.
And these guys did not have long hair, and they did not like people who did have long hair.
That's right.
So they were, shall we say, literally trying to trip up Don Nagy, our bass player. And Don was a pretty crazy guy. He was an ex-military policeman who had been stationed in Germany for many years and cracked a lot of heads of military and civilians.
He saved our lives a couple times.
Saved our lives a couple times. Well, what ended up happening was that these guys just picked on the wrong guy. I mean, they tried to trip Don as he walked by, and they were whooping it up and trying to get a yuck, yuck, yuck out of the long-haired goofball.
Yeah.
And the long-haired goofball grabbed him by the lapels and started wailing on this guy.
That's right. And then dragged him through the club.
Dragged him through the club and dragged him outside to finish him off.
Yeah, absolutely.
But before he could get outside.
That's right. There was. I'm going to tell my version of this.
Oh, John.
Because, see, Jimmy doesn't remember this.
Okay, folks, but I want equal time because he's going to tell you his version and I'm going to tell you mine.
Now, I'm standing by the cigarette machine watching all this go down. I'm horrified. And this Don is like pummeling this poor policeman here.
Off duty, plainclothes,
right.
L.A. cop.
Yeah, yeah. The other one is going to jump on Don from behind, and here comes Jimmy out of nowhere. And from my angle, it looked like Jimmy came from the floor up and hit this guy so hard that he went flying over a table onto his back on the bar. Now Jimmy says he just pushed this guy.
Okay, let's look at the replay and let's look at it in slow motion. The guy is going after Don. Don is wrestling with the other guy. This is all in slow motion now, folks.
Yeah.
So you gotta make sure you're set for slow mo out there. The guy on the ground is being pummeled by Don. The other guy goes to jump on Don's back, and much as I disliked Don at the time, I didn't think he deserved a fate like that.
No.
So I was a different person in those days. I just pushed this guy, and my back was to everybody. I pushed this guy over a table, and he literally went flying like in a Western movie. But everybody behind me, it was like throwing a movie punch. Everybody behind me thought I had literally punched him out, and for many years I lived off of that reputation. And you know what? Nobody messed with me. But it wasn't true. I just pushed the guy.
Yeah, you just pushed him, all right. I'll never believe that. I'll never believe that, man.
Nice to know I'm somebody's hero, John.
Well, you are. You've always been my hero, Jim. Ever since we were in the intellectual room together.
The intellectual room. Careful now.
So now, where everyone is on the West Coast, and Rastus goes into some other studio. What studio was it? Which one was it? Do you remember?
It was Hollywood Sound.
Hollywood Sound, okay. Yeah, that was about a block away from Hollywood Central. They go in and they cut, three, four tunes?
They cut three tunes, and honestly, John, I have to tell you, no offense to the work you did with them, because I know you did some great stuff with them, but I think what they cut at Hollywood Sound was, I think, where the band should have been and where they were, where they were going. The tracks were very tight. They were starting to become, on one hand, very commercial, and on the other hand, It was almost like they found their commercial selves, but yet could still do the heavier and more expanded version. So I think they had the best of both worlds. And I thought the stuff they came out of Hollywood Sound with sounded really good.
Yeah, we played some of that on the other two shows. I really probably should insert something here from that, but we played the stuff on the other two shows. So now they recorded. I do remember this. I remember that they were hardly speaking to each other.
Well,
that whole
engagement at that club, the Brass Ring, before and after the incident with Don, everybody was just at each other's throats. I mean, I was the audio guy / head of the crew, and my partner was this little guy, real sweet little guy named Robin Steinberg, who was Don's cousin, actually. And Robin and I just got along great. I mean, we were just great friends. We spent hours and hours and days in that truck driving across country with the band's gear and, you know, just living closely together and really got to know each other and really liked each other. But even Robin and I were at each other's throats that trip because it was trickling down. I mean, the band were screaming at each other. Everybody was... Now they had another thing to argue about, and that's pieces of the pie.
Yeah.
They were starting to see that there was money to be made here, and they were starting to argue about imaginary pieces of this pie that didn't even exist.
Yep.
Except in their minds, and who's going to get who, and who's going to pay for whose rent, and until things happened, and you know, there were 12 opinions, and none of them were on track. They needed a good guiding person. They needed good management, which they didn't have. God love him. Angelo did, you know, what he could to keep them on track. But they needed, at that point, their music was starting to sound a little, I don't want to say slicker, but a little more professional.
Yeah.
And their business was not keeping up with it.
Yeah.
And that was the point, I think, that the band reached. That was either the make or that was the fail-safe point. That was either make it or break it. And if they could have gotten their business end together and gotten decent management, and I think they would have really gone over the top because they had all the elements there at that time.
Tell me something. Who paid for those masters at Hollywood Sound?
You know, I honestly don't know.
Was that neighborhood? I mean, or was it just somebody funded some time? Or
I honestly don't remember. I honestly don't remember who paid for that, or who set us up with Hollywood Sound. It might have been another connection through Sonny Geraci, because I seem to remember that Brian Pinello, Ron Kramer was involved.
Ron Kramer, yeah, from the first album, from GRT.
Maybe not then. I'm honestly, John, I'm confused on that. I don't know.
Well, all I know is that then they left and went back to Cleveland, you know, and everybody had the blues, because I remember speaking to you and speaking to Smokey, I think, who were the only two that I really ever spoke to in the band, that things were tough and things were really hard, and everybody was going back to Cleveland. And we could play the blues here now, couldn't we?
Yeah. Well, we did. There's one other thing, though, that ties into all that, and that's that we did a gig in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And when you talk about the blues, that was the low part of my life, because we did a gig in Chicago. And at that point, the band was all they were just a mess. They were arguing and fighting with each other all the time, and I honestly thought I was seeing things clearly, and I had a kind of relationship with them where at that point I wasn't holding back, and I was just telling them, look, you know, I've been with hit bands. I know what it's like, and I know what you guys need, and you need to go in a certain direction. And it was just another voice in the mix, and they ended up firing me because they got sick of hearing me.
Yeah.
And at that time, everybody was so down and so depressed that, I mean, I could have said that God himself was coming, and it would have sounded like it would have sounded horrible, you know, yeah. Because we were all just in that frame of mind. But we were down, and that was the low point of my life. I ended up being fired by the band, and poor Robin did not have my, he didn't build the PA system from ground up like yeah. I did, so he didn't know it well enough to really carry on, and you know.
He didn't have the intestinal fortitude to deal with him, right?
He didn't know how to fight him off.
Well, let's see if we got this. What do you say?
Out
Down Blues and E. I remember writing that thing in the farmhouse in Chardon, Ohio. We had the blues then, and it looked like the blues is eating this band alive. And it's really too bad, because this is a band that truly could have made it if they had only had some financing, because they got better and better as time went on. So now the band goes back to Cleveland. What happened? Did you leave?
I was fired in Chicago, and I found my way back to Cleveland on my own.
Yeah.
Actually, what I did was I twisted Robin and Tony's. I was basically stranded in Chicago. I was left there.
My God.
And I remember practically breaking down my pal Robin's door, because at that point they had another guy named Tony who was sort of worthless as a roadie. He was more of a pretty boy type, and I practically broke down their door, and I said, listen, guys, I'm not staying here. I don't care where you're going in your truck. I know you're going east, and I don't really want to know, but I'm going with you. And when you turn off the highway, I'm getting out. So they got me as far as the border of Ohio, in Indiana and Ohio, and then they went south, and I continued along. I think it was 80, and I hitchhiked back to Cleveland, and had to call my father when I got to the, that's how young I was. I called my dad to pick me up at the exit nearest his house, and I was totally humiliated because I had to move back in with my parents, and ended up driving a cab. And at that point, Smokey, unbeknownst to me, had decided to leave the band, and he and I hooked up in Cleveland. Because he and I were great friends, you know, John and Smokey and I were the best of friends in those days. And Smokey and I hooked up and started talking to John long distance, because John was here in L.A. And we were making plans to make our move. And Smokey had all these mysterious things going on at that time. He had left the band under mysterious circumstances, and he wasn't even confiding in me at that time. And we just about knew everything about each other. We were real close friends, and he wasn't saying a word. I know he was going to a lot of doctor's appointments, and he decided that he wanted to move to L.A., and I always knew I wanted to be there. And to make ends meet, I was driving a taxi cab in a small town outside of Cleveland. until I could get enough money to move out here with Smokey.
Yeah.
And eventually, John offered us a place to live in a house that he and a couple other musicians were living in, and Smokey finally got the okay to make the move. And the one thing he did tell me was that his doctor had told him that he should give up playing drums and try to do something more humanitarian with his life.
A little less strenuous, too, right?
A little less strenuous and something to help people.
Yeah.
And so Smokey and I got a when we finally were ready to make the move, I had squirreled away a couple $100, which sounds like nothing now, but in those days was quite a bit of money. And we got one of those you drive it cars where you deliver a car across country for someone.
Yeah, I remember.
And we drove across country and moved in with our pal John here.
Yeah, that was a good thing. We had, I guess you guys had been there about how long? About a week?
We've been there about a week, yeah.
About a week, and I had been jogging. The house was in Glass Elk Park and was way up on a hill and was backed up by Forest Lawn Cemetery. So we're like way up on top of a hill and had this great view. And I had started running to get myself in shape, and I remember a couple of days after Jimmy and Smokey had come to town, Smokey said, "I want to run with you." And, of course, Jimmy and I were concerned because Smokey had always had a bad heart. We'd always kind of expected Smokey to go out playing drums, actually. So anyway, I think on a Monday, I went running and Smokey went with me. And he wasn't in that great a shape.
I was sitting on the edge of my bed, yawning.
Yeah. So we ran down the hill. It was like two or three blocks down the hill and two or three blocks over and then two or three blocks back up the hill. And it wasn't that it was that long, but it was strenuous because it was going up a hill. And so the second day, which was a Tuesday, I believe, we were running. And coming back up the hill, Smokey looked over at me and said, "I'm going to beat you this time, man." He took one more step and dropped. And I freaked out. And I mean, there was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could do. I got hold of Jimmy. Jimmy called 911.
I think I made it halfway down the hill. I heard John screaming, and I ran halfway down the hill with no shoes on and no socks and a pair of cutoffs. And just I saw Smokey laying there on the ground and turned right around and ran back up the hill and called 911 and ran back down to wait for them. And John and I both, I think John might have been holding him, and I think we were trying to both revive him, and he gave one big, I'll never forget it as long as I live, one big last exhalation of air, a big sigh, and he was gone. He was dead.
He was gone.
At 25 years old, he was dead.
What a shame. One of the greatest drummers of all time. I mean, just an immaculate drummer, and he had the opportunity to go with Chicago, remember?
He had done a session before, too, the night he had done a session the night before and had carried his drums from the street all the way up the hill. And, you know, we both react in different ways. John reacted like he reacts, and I reacted like I react in those situations. And we both kind of came together on calling up this guy that he did the session for and literally threatening the guy. We said, "Listen, if we find out that you gave our friend something that killed him, you're next.
You're next, buddy. You're next." But,
and I think John, I think John did the honors on that one, but I was right in sync with him. We felt the same way.
You know me, I do have a bad temper. At least I used to, anyway. But we all miss Smokey very much, and we're going to close this show and this set on Rastus with a tune that Smokey wrote. I think he wrote it along with, Tony Correo, and Smokey wrote this tune.
I just want to say one thing before we close, and that's that 30-some years have gone by, and I still think of Smokey at least once a week. And
absolutely.
More often than that at times.
Yeah. So let's play this. We're going to go out with this tune called What Will It Take? And it actually tells where Smokey's head was at the time, and the band, actually, because it's a very, very positive tune. And it kind of fits into the world situation right now, too, don't you think, Jim?
I think it's perfect for the times.
Thank you, everyone. This is John Reese speaking for my friend Jim Cantelli, thanking you for joining us on BluePower.com. Thanks so much for all the cards and letters and the internet mail, the email that we've gotten regarding these shows. Please let us know if there's anything you'd like to hear. Send it to John Reese, one word, at BluePower.com. We'll do whatever you like.
Situation.